Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Local writer-photographer Douglas Keister has authored and co-authored 49 books, many of them on architecture or cemeteries. When he was featured on CBS Sunday Morning, Rita Braver dubbed him America's chief tombstone tourist. He has written books about his childhood in Nebraska, and in 2019 he published People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise about the November 2018 campfire. Douglas Keister's latest book is unlike any of his previous 48 books. Lilith and the Holy Man is fiction, but contains a lot of facts. Douglas Keister, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you tell your story in the first person. You have a character who tells it in the first person.
Right.
But I'm always curious as how in the world did he come up with this idea to write this book? And so I'm going to ask you to read what you have to say in the first person. This is you now talking. So I'm going to ask you to read a part of your book where you tell us about writing this book, Lilith and the Holy Man?
Yeah. As a little preface to that, I've always enjoyed Hieronymus Bosch's work, not the TV guy, but the painter from 500 years ago. And I was at the Prado Museum in Madrid a long time ago, and I saw a painting called Garden of Earthly Delights. And I became fascinated with it. Here and there over the years, and then one day, I don't know what happened, I just decided I'm going to craft a story around that. I don't know why, but once I kind of get my claws into something, I just start gnawing away at it. And so I came up with a story about one of the hidden figures in that painting.
Well, many years ago, I went to the Prado, and I'm sure I walked right past this painting because it was so busy, and I thought, I don't understand that. So I'm sure I just walked right past it, didn't make an impression on me at all, which kind of surprises me because when I mentioned to friends I'm reading this book about the Garden of Earthly Delights, how many people are familiar with this painting? I've been surprised.
It's amazing, actually, how many people know that painting. They may not know much about it, but it is just – it's like when I first saw it, as not as the painting, but as a picture in a book or something like that, I thought it was fairly modern because of the intricacy of it. I did not – if it was painted during the Spanish Inquisition, when to paint anything that was delved into maybe a little religious controversy was punishable by
– Oh, yeah. The Spanish Inquisition.
So to get to your question – what I decided to do after I actually finished the book was I have so much in there about – in my head about Lilith that I want to explain that. I didn't want to put it directly in the book as a long sort of thing. So what I did was a rather extensive author's notes at the end of the book.
Yeah. In fact, I started reading your book from the beginning, and then I happened to flip over and see in the back of your book, author's note – on Lilith, Bosch, and the woman who refused. So, would you read us what you wrote in your author's note?
And you started it off, and then the subtitle of that little piece is How a Woman Hidden in a 500-Year-Old Painting Became a Major Character in My Book, Lilith and the Holy Man. When I began writing Lilith and the Holy Man, my intention was to write a love story set in Madrid's Prado Museum, built around one of the most extraordinary paintings I have ever stood in front of, Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights. I plan to include a brief mention of the biblical character Lilith to explain my Lilith's in the book motivation. However, some of the best characters in books often arrive uninvited, and that's exactly what happened. I've spent much of my career as an author looking closely at things most people walk past. 49 books, 6 of them novels, many of them devoted to cemetery symbolism and historic architecture. The story is encoded in stone and wood and paint that reward the patient observer. I'm always more interested in the why and the how of the backstory than what is presented up front. So, when I first stood before the Garden of Earthly Delights and really looked at it, not glanced at it, not checked it off a list, but truly looked, I found myself with more questions than answers, which, in my experience, is always the beginning of something interesting.
So I think that's what I did. I just glanced at it, and I didn't even have it on a list to check off, but I just glanced at it, walked on past. And you say you're always more interested in the why and how of the backstory than what is presented up front. And I think that's what makes your book so interesting.
Well, that's also, in my photography, back when I first started as kind of a journalist sort of thing, I tell people I'm more interested in getting a backstage pass than a front row seat. I want to know what's going on to put this thing together rather than just looking at it. Mm-hmm. So that's my experience with Hieronymus Bosch's painting.
Okay, so most scholars agree.
Yes. The painting, most scholars agree, was almost certainly completed in the 1490s during the height of the Spanish Inquisition. Bosch was a celebrated artist working for European nobility at a time when religious orthodoxy was not merely a social expectation, but a matter of life and death. And yet, here was this astonishing, wildly imaginative, frankly sensual triptych full of naked figures, fantastical creatures, and giant strawberries and birds, which were symbols of sexuality, and imagery that has entertained and confounded viewers across five centuries. The German art historian Edwin Pawlowski, one of Bosch's great scholars, wrote that despite all the research devoted to decoding the painting, he felt the real secret of Bosch's nightmares and daydreams had yet to be disclosed. "We have bored a hole through the door of a locked room," he said, "but we do not seem to have discovered the key." I love that image, holes in a locked door. It stayed with me. It also fit into my holy man theme.
My guest is Chico author Douglas Keister. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author and photographer Douglas Keister, and he is reading about his notes from his newest book, Lilith and the Holy Man. And this is an opportunity, since listeners can't see how this word holy is spelled, you say you love the images of holes in a locked door.
Yes.
So how do you spell the Holy Man?
Yeah, we spell holy man, H-O-L-E-Y. And it also refers to a kind of a working theme that I have my whole life, is that we're all full of holes, we fill them. We fill them with food, we fill them with air, we fill them with water, we fill them with love, we fill them with endeavors. And it's a constant thing. We fill ourselves up and they get drained. And sometimes we fill ourselves up with things we shouldn't be filling ourselves up with. and some people, well, it's money and power and things like that. So it's kind of this ongoing process for us. And this guy in the book is, you know, this woman he meets describes him as being full of holes. And she says, I am too.
You know, my experience is a hole in my heart. When my husband died,
right.
And it's something I can't really get over, I feel a hole in my heart.
Yes, that's exactly what my character was talking about and describing him. I mean, she could see it. He's this kind of straight ahead, button down kind of guy, and she's much more effervescent, shall we say. And you know, she saw him and she could see the hole. You know, and he said, "Well, I'm just fine," or something. Then he said, "Yeah, well, you're right." You know, so Lilith is a character in the book. There are two Liliths. One is the woman that he meets, but he doesn't know that's her name because it's her persona. And then there is the biblical Lilith, and. So I have in my notes, I describe it in detail about the biblical Lilith.
And, you know, I think people may have heard the name before, but I don't think people realize what a long history. And you have a section in your author's notes, Lilith through the centuries.
Yeah, yeah.
So this guy is painting this painting maybe 500 years ago. But then we have, through the centuries, you mention once you start looking for Lilith in Western culture, you find her everywhere. For example, 1808, Goethe's Faust brought her to mainstream literary attention and Adam's beautiful and dangerous first wife. And then you mention others, John Keats, inspired by Goethe, wove her into La Belle Dame sans Merci. And this Roman translation of Lilith, a temptress who lures men into their ruin. So here's another Pre-Raphaelite painter, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, gave her perhaps her most iconic visual in Lady Lilith. So this a woman utterly at home in her own power.
Yeah.
Oh, now the last century, you can't have that.
Yeah.
Self-possessed and unashamed. Her famous hair, loose and flowing, both a warning and an invitation. Why don't you pick up there with this history of Lilith?
And if we bring it forward a little bit, Scottish author, and this is in the notes, Scottish author George MacDonald published his dark fantasy novel, Lilith, in 1895, which directly influenced C.S. Lewis's White Witch in the Narnia series. Lewis specifying that the witch is descended from Lilith. She turns up as the first vampire in True Blood, as the queen of demons in Supernatural, as the complex anti-heroine in Netflix's Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and is the morally ambiguous authority figure in The Owl House. In video games, music, tattoo culture, and feminist theology, she is everywhere. And then there is a Lilith most of us know, Dr. Lilith Sternan, played by Bebe Neuwirth in the television series Cheers. Perhaps the most well-known and surprisingly modern-day Lilith of them all. Dr. Lilith Sternan was the psychiatrist of formidable intelligence who refused to soften herself for a bar full of men, who did not giggle or apologize for being the smartest person in the room, who declined to perform warmth on demand.
You know, when I'm looking at this character, Lilith, I thought of my mother, who was very opposite. If Lilith had an opposite.
Yeah.
Because my sister-in-law one time was asking my mother's opinion, well, what should I do? And my mother's reply was, well, whatever my husband wanted me to do. And oh, my goodness.
Things have changed.
Things have changed. Yes, I agree with you there. So these notes in the back of your book help us to understand how you came about writing this book.
Right, and we could delve into something else, which is, I think, worthy, is Lilith, the biblical Lilith that's woven into the book is what's called a MacGuffin.
Yes, and that's something I think people would be interested in. And what in the world? Spell that word or that word again.
That's a MacGuffin.
Yeah.
It was first, let's say, popularized by
Alfred
Hitchcock. And a MacGuffin is something in a novel or in a story or movie that's present kind of all the time, kind of a thread that connects everything, that helps the characters get developed. One in particular everybody would know would be the Maltese Falcon. You know, it's always there.
Yeah.
It allows the characters to get developed. In Pulp Fiction, which most people know, there's a briefcase. But it never actually gets opened. But it allows all the characters to get developed. Specifically, something like the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
You know, so it's this thing that is there for the whole time. And in my book, the biblical Lilith is there the whole time, and she goes through all the different characters. She's always kind of lurking. So,
yeah, I think I found that really interesting. This plot device that has a name, a label, MacGuffin, is a plot device. And you mentioned that Alfred Hitchcock named this that drives a story, even though it's not in itself that important.
Right, right. But in Lilith and the Holy Man, it's kind of, well, she's a MacGuffin, but then she's also something else. But that's the definition of MacGuffin. It's always there.
Yeah,
you know, to the degree is kind of up in the air.
Well, that's one of the interesting facts, I think, that people would find. Oh, yeah, I remember a story like that or a movie like that. So let's meet the characters in your book. Why don't you start pretty much at the beginning of this story? And we have this character now is, when you read I now, it's not going to be you, the author. It's going to be you, the character.
Right.
And we learn his name is Sam.
Yes, the guy, the main male character in the book, his name's Sam. He's from San Francisco. He is what you might be called a button-down sort of person, somebody with not a lot of emotion, a straight-ahead kind of guy. So I'm describing Sam in his own words in the beginning because Sam is, you know, writing this book.
Yes.
And Sam describes himself as, I'm not particularly enamored with rigid religious-themed paintings. It seems that the paintings are either angels or people with halos or saints or sinners in various states of agony or ecstasy or some kind of combination of those elements. When some friends suggested that the next time I visit Madrid, I journey to the Museum del Prado to see a religious-themed painting called The Garden of Earthly Delights, I agreed, but my expectations were markedly low. My expectations changed the moment someone showed me a fold-out postcard of the painting. I was intrigued in a clinical sort of way. Thus, on a warm afternoon a few months later, I was sitting on a long bench at the Museum del Prado listening to an explanation of Hieronymus' painting, The Garden of Earthly Delights, in my earbuds. When I walked into the gallery, I couldn't help but notice an attractive young woman on another bench. It was hard to ignore what was obviously very long red hair stacked atop her head like a malformed mountain of cotton candy, held together with a trio of chopsticks. I have an attraction, my friends say fatal, to red-haired women. Most of the ones I have known have embraced their redheadedness and expressed it with passion and unpredictability, which, despite my linear brain leanings, I find tremendously alluring. I quickly moved past her, shaking my head, chiding myself, hoping she hadn't noticed me, staring. It didn't matter. Fate intervened. 2 minutes after I sat down, the cotton candy-topped woman snared me.
Oh, this is my guest, Douglas Keister, a local author and photographer. And this book that he's reading from is Lilith and the Holy Man. And the person they're talking right now is that holy man. And at this point in the story, we don't know why he's a holy man. But he sees this woman with red hair, and we learn she has green eyes. And I went back to when I went to the Prado, I had red hair and green eyes. But I had met my husband-to-be right before that, and it was love at first sight. So I don't have any trouble believing in love at first sight because I experienced that. Now, when people are reading your book, I wonder, that's fiction.
Yeah. I think, you know, I in the book, I called it the lightning bolt.
Yes, yes.
It's just that you have no control over it.
In fact, that's the French expression, says coup de foudre. Yeah. It's a lightning bolt.
Yeah.
Love at first sight.
And it's just, yeah, it's the same thing. I just, I use the lightning bolt instead. But it's the same, yeah, the same idea. And both of them experience that.
Yes.
And then because this is a novel, it's a story, it doesn't like...
And they lived happily ever after. Yeah, that would have been a very short book.
Yeah, a very, very short book. So without giving a tremendous amount away, you know, that happens and then something untoward happens. And they have to go searching for each other, you know, across continents.
And, you know, one thing that she leaves with him... that we don't know at the time. Oh, yeah, a couple of earrings. So
yeah.
What? So, but we come back to what is engraved on one of these earrings?
Right, right. Yeah, she just, when she introduces herself, she can't quite make up her mind who she is because she kind of, she has a regular name, which, oh, I could say it's Eve, unfortunately, which she doesn't like. And so over the years, she keeps changing her name. And when she introduces herself, she calls herself Electra.
Which you explain in case people, what, Electra? Oh, what's that? And it comes from?
It comes from the Pleiades, the constellation. And it's kind of the most hidden of all of the stars. And so it's a whole thing about Electra.
That's one of the, only one of the names that she said. When he wants to know her name, he gives her his name. And
yeah, Scarlet, Electra.
Well, I'm guessing, well, she had red hair, so I guess Scarlet.
Yeah.
And then...
Then when something happens that they have to get parted,
yeah.
She leaves a coffee cup that has, she has gone down to get coffee for both of them. She leaves a coffee cup that says Lilith on it. And she leaves two earrings. And one of the earrings is solid gold, and it says Lilith on it, and the other says friend. And so she's called him her friend, and she said friends are harder to keep than lovers, you know. So anyway, so these two earrings, all he knows is these two earrings, one saying Lilith, one says friend, and the coffee cup that says Lilith. That's all he knows.
Well, now, when we read this, we think, friend, okay, they're friends. But that's not the kind of friend that we think it is. Do we dare give away?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
People will forget.
Okay. Well, I mentioned when I introduced you that you wrote a book about growing up in Nebraska.
Right, right.
And how does that play a role in this book?
Well, one of the things they say when you're writing, or it's common, you write what you know. And that doesn't just mean what you know internally, it's what you know externally. And I grew up in Nebraska, and my relatives lived about 45 minutes from Lincoln, which is also in the book, in a little town called Friend.
A town. The name of the town is Friend.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So he knows that she did tell him that she was from Lincoln. But you could say, you know, you were from Sacramento, but you're really from Roseville.
Well, I had a friend who lived in Albany and other places. He'd just say he lived in Berkeley.
Yeah.
Because people know Berkeley. They don't know Albany. But so she just says, yeah, she's from...
I live in Lincoln, yeah.
But we learn,
maybe
it's a town.
Yeah.
So he's really playing detective now, trying to... Because he's in love with this woman.
Yeah, yeah. And he, you know, he works for Google... And other software companies.
In the Bay Area.
In the Bay Area. And so he uses everything at his disposal to try to, you know, facial recognition and...
Oh, yeah. That was very interesting, too, because all that is true.
Right, right. But he doesn't even have a picture of her. You know, he didn't... Because they thought, once they met, that this is it. But, you know, so he didn't take a picture, didn't give her a phone number, nothing.
But then there's video, but video of, say, a hotel lobby is not very clear.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a, so, you know, you can narrow things down to how many percentage of redheads in the population.
Which is very low.
But nevertheless, thousands, if yeah. tens of thousands.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so yeah. he's armed with just very little information. And she is, too. She's looking for him, too. All she knows is Sam from San Francisco. Well, there's a number of Sams.
Yeah, and just make sure you don't call it Frisco.
Right, yes, I put that in the...
I noticed that amused me, too, because I know people from San Francisco don't call it.
And of course, he's not really from San Francisco because he does the same thing. He says from San Francisco, but it's not, you know, it's around San Francisco. Yeah.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Chico author Douglas Keister. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Chico author Douglas Keister, and we're talking about his 49th book, Lilith and the Holy Man. And this word holy, H-O-L-E-Y, as in whole, like I mentioned, you can have a hole in your heart.
Yeah.
So, unbeknownst to either of them, they're looking for each other.
Right.
And what else? We don't want to give away too much of this story. But what else can you tell people?
I think both of them meet people on their search. One of them is what we would call maybe a Gypsy or Romani woman.
Yeah,
and other people as well. And the message from these people is enjoy the journey. That you may never find this person. Don't put all your energy into the destination. Learn things as you go. And that's kind of the life's message, too. You don't just be looking at the destination all the time. And because if you don't reach it, you'll be so devastated. Enjoy the journey and what you may learn along the way. Whether you meet this person or not, the journey is what's most important.
I do think that's an important lesson. I really do. And for example, I walked a pilgrimage across Spain, and you're going to a cathedral, but that's really,
yeah.
It's the journey, yeah. The process. But I wanted to get back to this fact that he's trying to find her, and so he dresses like a Google employee with his clipboard, yeah. And he's going to track her down. And one of the people that he meets, she's quite an older lady, but this part of your book, too, sent me off on a journey myself because some time ago I inherited a deck of tarot cards. I don't know anything about tarot cards. But when I was reading your book, I thought, oh, I've got a deck of tarot cards. I've got a book that explains them. So I got down my deck and I started looking at these cards and then I'd read the section of your book about it. So who is this person? Why did tarot cards come to play in your story?
It's just, well, because one of the characters is a gypsy woman, 104 years old.
104 years
yeah,
old, yeah.
In the book. And another one is another woman he meets has tarot cards. So there's just, you know, the way that you put out tarot cards, the way you flip them, the message that you may or may not want to embrace. And of course, you know, for the purposes of the book, what the tarot card that he gets helps him along his journey.
So as I'm reading this, I'm wondering, well, Doug, do you know about tarot cards? Do you have experience with them? Because I've been surprised that I was talking to some woman. She said, yeah, her husband was interested in them. What? I mean, here's this serious professor, and her husband is interested in tarot cards? So were you familiar with tarot cards, or did you do research
I was familiar with them. You know, I've spent a lot of time in Berkeley, you know.
But people
that would know that sort of thing. But obviously, in order to – I want to get it right.
Oh, yeah, because people who do know – uh-oh.
Yeah, you got to get that right. And, you know, Wendy has a lot of tarot card decks. So we do that, you know, every year, you know, New Year's, we do the tarot thing.
So you've had readings, tarot card readings yourself.
Yeah, I'm not sure how well I've my expectations have been different. So, but it, you know, it's kind of a guidepost. Uh-huh. You know, it kind of validates your journey, or maybe I need to change something. It's just another mile marker.
But you must find it worthwhile. If you do this, you say New Year's or January?
Uh-huh. It's kind of like a New Year's resolution, that sort of thing. And tarot cards themselves, the physical cards, are just fascinating. I mean, they're wonderful, you know. It really beats a deck of regular cards. But, you know, regular cards, there are a lot of similarities in them, but...
Well, I went to, this was the Bay Area, I think it was Palo Alto, and happened to drive by this place, and I was trying to make a decision about a job, whether to go with a new job. And I didn't really look at the cards. This woman told me things that I thought, what she's saying really agrees with my impression. But I did not look at the cards. So after I was reading your book, I opened the cards out, and they're complicated. Yeah. So you want to give an example of what one of the cards drawn in your story?
Well, the one of the ones that he draws, as does she, that's, you know, is called the Wheel of Fortune. And that one is a real affirmation of what you're doing is the correct thing and to continue on the journey. That's sometimes that card is also called the fates. Mm-hmm. You know, what's your fate's going to be? Mm-hmm. Also in the book, you know, I begin and end with a quote from Marcus Aurelius about following your fate, honor your fate. So that's there's a lot of crossover. That sort of thing. And also, I don't think I'm giving anything away, that one of my favorite quotes is, when you take a journey and you come back to where started, you see it in a completely different way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people experience that and know, there's truth to that. Yeah, that loop.
Yeah.
But now, suppose you draw a tarot card. I don't know if you draw it is the word. And it says death on it.
That's not death.
I wanted to give you a chance to say that in case people, what? I'm going to die.
Yeah. There's other cards which I can't, which do connotate death, but not the death card. Other cards that do say, your little journey may be coming to an end soon. Mm-hmm. Now, it could be the death of something else, not just your personal death, but perhaps the death of a relationship or some goal that you've had or something like that. But the death card itself, no.
Well, if I was this character and I was 104, I wouldn't be too shocked if I drew a card and said death at age 104.
That might happen in the book. We don't know for sure, do we?
No. Well, so that, like I say, when I'm reading your book, I thought, I'm going to look that up. And so when I was reading, for example, about Lincoln, Nebraska and a town named Friend, and I thought, now, I bet this is true. But I Google things.
Yeah.
And, it told me there's this little town called Friend.
Yeah, that's where my mother's side, that's where my mother grew up, in Friend, and or a farm outside of Friend. But she went to school in Friend. And you can actually get postcards in Friend that say, write a friend from Friend.
I'm wondering when I'm reading your book, too, how much of this is your own personal experience? Like, you definitely know Friend, Nebraska.
Yeah, yeah. And because I put Lincoln, Nebraska in there.
Yes.
And I put San Francisco and the Bay Area and Madrid, you know. So, like I say, you write what you know. But it's not just the external right, which, you know, it's the internal too, you know, the experience of feeling empty because something, you've lost something, and searching, and unexpected things, you know, all the times in our lives when we've had to, you know, turn left or turn right, you know, or go straight, whatever it happens to be, all of those little tiny things that make a huge difference.
Oh, yeah.
Also, there's other characters. I got a lot of other characters in the book, and in Madrid and in Lincoln, and also in San Francisco. So what's fun is that I could mine my experiences with people. So it's not just Sam and Lilith, Electra, Eve, Evelyn, all of that. It's all these other people too. So that was really kind of fun because I'm writing about people I know. You know, I'm changing their names, of course, but the way that they're approaching life and things that happen to them and why they are who they are. So you kind of weave all that in there and make them really a really big part of the story.
My guest is local author and photographer Douglas Keister, and we're talking about his 48th book, Lilith and the Holy Man. Now, I usually, since listeners can't see the cover of a book, I usually ask an author often to describe the cover. But, oh, my goodness. Can you even describe this?
Well,
what is it? What is on the cover of your book?
Well, the cover is a detail from that painting, The Garden of Earthly Delights. The painting, painted by Hieronymus Bosch, 1490.
Who was not, people might be surprised, he was not Spanish.
No, he was Netherlandish.
Yes.
And it's a triptych. So it folds, you know, and actually if it was in a church.
And TRI meaning three.
Yeah, three, so. Triptych. And usually it would be folded in, and then at certain times it would be, the whole thing would be folded out. But now, of course, it's all folded out. So the first triptych, the first panel, is the Garden of Eden, and it's got people you would think would be in the Garden of Eden, but
yeah.
It also has all of these fantastical animals in it.
Yeah, because all we know, there's Adam and Eve and a snake, the characters that we know.
Actually, there's no snake.
I'm saying what we think
you,
we know.
Right, yes.
I'm not saying there was, yeah. but that's about all the characters we know growing up in the Garden of Eden. Yeah, there's Adam and Eve and a snake.
Yeah, yeah. And then the second panel, which is the largest panel, the center panel, is the Garden of Earthly Delights. And somebody counted, not me, that there are actually 500 people in that panel.
That's why I'm thinking that when I was in the Prado, I must have just walked right by it, because 500 people?
Naked people.
Yes, 500 naked people in this painting. And
they're it's the Garden of Earthly Delights. You know, so they're very happy people, and all sorts of people. I mean, there's blacks, there's brown, there's white, and there's men and women, and women and women, and men. Yeah, it's just all of this, and there's these enormous birds, and lots of strawberries.
Yeah, and that strawberries. So that's strange enough to see all these birds and rats and, but strawberries.
Yeah, it's a. It was a sexual reference about the sweetness of strawberries.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that panel is the Garden of Earthly Delights, and the third panel is hell, which is the price you pay.
Which you don't put on the cover, because I asked you to describe the cover. You put the first panel and then the second panel, thank you for
I describe hell in the book.
Yeah, but thank you for not putting it on the cover.
Oh, It's horrible, but it's the price you pay for having fun, you know. According to
for those earthly delights that are depicted in the second panel.
And it's, once again, it's during the Spanish Inquisition, so there has to be a price for having fun. I also refer in the book to The Last Judgment, also painted by Bosch, and it's in Vienna, which I've also seen, and that one is really dark. It's just really, all three panels are really dark. But the Garden of Earthly Delights is, I mean, some scholars, well, it's in the top 10 paintings in the world. and by some scholars. Some scholars will say it's number one.
Oh, my goodness.
It beats the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, well, like I say, I was surprised how many people, when I just informally asking people, and they right away, they knew, yeah, the Garden of Earthly Delights.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those one of those paintings. And, I mean, there's scholars that just go, I mean, considering it's 500 years old.
Yeah.
It's one thing to be some, you know, kind of modern painting like that. But
well, how would you describe how would you label it as what kind of art style, stylistically?
Well, it's kind of a realism because it's...
Or more than realism, which would
surrealism,
be...
Surrealism. Yeah, surrealism. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything is... real looking.
It's yes, not, yes, yes.
And but you know, you know, having these people riding birds, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of surrealistic.
And here's a body inside a clamshell.
There are two bodies in there.
Yes, you can see the feet of the other body.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
So, two bodies in a clamshell. That's bizarre.
Well, yeah. You know, there's lots, like we said earlier on, the quote, people have been trying to figure this thing out for 500 years because there's nothing contemporary written about it. And the painting did go to different locations over time. It wound up in the Prado in 1939. Mm-hmm. But it went to churches and it was commissioned by a prince or something like that. It's written, I have that all in the book.
Yeah.
So you have to see it. You just have, even if it's just...
I can't even convey to listeners if they've never seen it. That, for example, there's a unicorn.
Yeah.
The title of the book, Lilith, and there's a unicorn between the I and the T of Lilith.
Yeah.
A unicorn. Okay, yeah, so yeah, it's a unicorn.
Elephants and just some animals that don't really exist in nature. he's just made up. After you read the book, you know, you might want to go look at the hell panel. Just to see, because part of that is the story, too. There's lots of people in the hell panel that are being punctured, you know, impaled by various things. So that's also part of the holy man sort of thing.
Well, because your book does, on the cover, in color, bright color, depict... the first panel and the second panel, I wanted to see the whole thing too. So I Googled it and I didn't really find a satisfying reproduction of that painting.
They're out there.
Yeah, I'll keep looking because I could see you could spend a lot of time.
Oh, you could dive into it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I said, somebody spent a lot of time counting 500 people.
Yes, 500 figures in this painting.
And just in the center panel.
Yeah, just in the center panel.
Yeah.
So we have these two characters that are looking for each other. They meet, they love at first sight.
Yeah.
And they're in love, and they get separated. They lose track of each other, but they want to find each other. Now, do we want to tell them? We've told them kind of how they go about it. So yeah. Sam makes a trip as a Google employee, makes a trip to Nebraska. And what about Lilith?
Yeah, well, Lilith she knows that Sam is from San Francisco and that he works as a contractor for Google and eBay and a couple others. So, that's Silicon Valley stuff. So she goes to Silicon Valley and she goes to Google. And, of course, they're not going to tell her anything.
Oh, no.
Well,
Yes.
But nevertheless, she meets somebody outside of Google, who also takes her on a journey and takes her to a cemetery in Colma.
The cemetery expert says.
Yes, so I had to put a cemetery in there.
Of course.
And it also has this woman that he meets as a grief counselor that he just happens to meet in Mountain View. But she takes him to the cemetery in Cypress Lawn Cemetery in Colma. And says, I got to show you this one tombstone. And it's Lefty O'Doul's tombstone, which is one of my favorite epitaphs of all time. And Lefty O'Doul was a baseball player in the 1930s. And it says,
you who play baseball yourself,
yes,
you're in Chico.
I do. Well, yes. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I show up and I throw the ball, hit the ball sometimes. And but the Lefty O'Doul's tombstone says, he was here at a good time. and had a good time when he was here.
Yes.
And so this woman who talks to Lilith wants to show her that you're it's the journey. Have a good time when you're here. You know, so.
Well, now, if the two of them are in love, how do they get separated? I don't think we want to tell that. Do you understand why? Because that's part of the mystery is what happened? She said, I'll be back here. I'm going to leave these earrings. I'll be back.
Yeah.
And he expected her back within a few minutes, maybe.
Oh, yeah. She said, I have something to do.
I have something to do. And we don't know then, right then. So I don't want to give away why she didn't come right back and why they have to spend the
4 years.
4 years looking for each other.
Yeah. We can't tell this.
No, let's not tell that.
Yeah. And whether or not at the end do they actually find each other?
Yes. Does this story have a happy ending or not?
Well, maybe. One of my favorite. I don't know why very few people know this story, but when I was growing up, I remember reading a story called The Lady and the Tiger.
Yeah.
And not too many people know that story. And it ends, this book does not end this way, with this door opening. And is it the lady or the tiger? You know, in the story that you and I know, we don't know. But that we do know in this story what happens. But each of them has to take their own journey and, you know, go through their search for each other, but also to experience other things on the way. And at the end, they've learned things, and maybe they'll meet each other, but maybe the situation is different than it was. Maybe.
Maybe. And I think this is an interesting point to leave the listeners wondering.
That's right.
So thank you for writing this mystery, Doug.
Thank you.
My guest has been Douglas Keister, and his book is Lilith and the Holy Man. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Then and now, things change. Back then, I used to twist apples in half, much to the delight of grandkids. But now, I've got trigger finger. That has stopped the whole process. So I use a knife to pre-cut it. The kids are still stunned, but my fingers still hurt. Back then, my shirt collars used to fit tightly around my neck, especially when I wore a tie. But now, the Sunday newspaper, the one-ed section, is best to take up the extra space. Back then, the steering wheel had two uses, steering, hence the name, and honking. But now, steering wheels have radio controls, speed settings, phone contacts, window wipers, and a variety of other things that I have not yet figured out. I've only had the car for 14 years. I'll get it. Back then, I never had to give my birth date at the doctor's office. But now, it's mandatory. Now, we will all identify by our birth dates. 7374, you're next. Hello, 2655. Back then, hand scoring in bowling was difficult. It was challenging, and it was fun. But now, the overhead screens keep track of everything. There are no extra rolls, no do-overs, and you can't even fudge on the scores. And I wonder who I could call if I have a dispute with the score. The machine? Back then, Little League teams used to have the name of the Major League teams. But now, they identify with the sponsors. Lane Legal Law Offices versus Donaldson's Donuts. Doesn't sound quite the same as A's versus O's. Back then, I used to give real high fives. The grandkids were laughing, never able to reach my hand. But now, shoulders are bad, implants, and I have to give low fives. The grandkids are ecstatic. Back then, I was summoned by my mom to read instructions for her recipes. But now, I need Pammy to read the directions on my pill bottles. Where did my 20/60 eyesight go? Back then, I used to gulp down ice-cold blended beverages, but now I need to consider the dreaded brain freeze. Back then, I never had to adjust the driver's seat, but now, when I get ready to drive, I have to raise it to be able to see over the steering wheel. Did I shrink from my waist to my head? Back then, receipts used to be given without any question, but now we are given alternatives. Do you want it in the bag, on your phone, printed, or not at all? I usually pick for not at all. Otherwise, I just take them home and throw them away anyway. Back then, a pair of 1.75 glasses was adequate for reading. But now, reading is a challenge, even with 3.0 readers. Does my vision have an expiration date? Back then, I never had to mute the landline phone. But now, my iPhone has to be muted or bear the brunt of people being annoyed during Hamlet's soliloquy. Okay, I can mute it. Maybe you can listen to Polonius or Rosencrantz. They have speaking parts in Hamlet. Back then, I never had to tap my credit card on a card scanner. But now it has become a game of whack-a-mole. No, that's not it. Nope, that's not the spot. Oh, there it is. Back then, self-checkout lines were convenient and speedy. But now you have to have a person come if there's any type of problem with the machine. There goes convenience and speed. Back then, sports heroes were heroes on the field. But now they advertise everything from A to Z, Asics to zucchini. Back then, I never misplaced or lost our landline phone. Never, ever. But now it's almost a daily occurrence with me. I know, it's a problem. I can call my landline phone from Pammy's phone. And if she's not around, I am stuck. Back then, passwords were simple. But now they are either too short, too long, need a capital, some symbol, or it's too similar to my other 37 passwords. Back then, I used to enjoy singing Happy Birthday, but now it sounds so off-key, I'm not even sure that the birthday person is pleased with the song at all. Back then, I used to fool myself into believing that I was younger. But now, if a 20% discount or a senior discount is available, I speak up. Hey, I'm a senior. I qualify. The cashier looks at me. Oh yeah, I got that while you were waiting in line. Geez, do I look that old already? The then and now are a lesson in absolute contradictions. Mark Mallinger.
The sun and moon. The sun kissed the moon, now the moon is tan. The orb of night smiles now. It used to frown down at us with an unwavering dissatisfaction. The sun shines brighter in the sky than I've ever seen, making my palms and the back of my hands a different color. Yet, they are so far away. They have never connected. Thus, the moon is still tan, and the sun still makes me sweaty. Leah Kammerer.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.